Rebecca Lavoie, your host for the Undisclosed Addendum episodes on the Pam Lanier case. You might know me as the audio producer for Undisclosed, but I'm also a journalist, the author of several true crime books, and the host of the podcast Crime Writers On. This week, the Undisclosed team premiered their third episode on the case of Pam Lanier, who was convicted in the 1997 death of her husband, Doran, in Chincapin, North Carolina. This episode focused on the 2 months between Doran's bulldozer accident in September 1997 and his death on November 19th. Today, we have three guests joining me for this conversation. Our first guest is Allison Sweeney. She's an award-winning actress known for Days of Our Lives and for hosting The Biggest Loser. And recently, it was announced that she will executive produce and star in the Chronicle Mysteries for Hallmark Movies and Mysteries as Robbie McPherson, a first-time podcaster pursuing the cold case of a childhood friend. Allison Sweeney, it's so great to talk to you again.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Our second guest is Marcia Chatelain. Professor Chatelain is a Provost Distinguished Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University. She's also the author of Southside Girls, Growing Up in the Great Migration, and a prolific consumer of all things true crime. And finally, Marcia, of course, was one of the hosts of the Undisclosed Freddie Gray series. Hello, Marcia.
Hi, Rebecca. Good to be back.
Good to be back and talking to you as well. And finally, Legal Serious with us, one of the hosts of Undisclosed, Colin Miller. He is the blog editor of Evidence Prof Blog and a law professor and associate dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law and everyone's favorite instructor on all things related to crime and courts and cases and just about everything. Colin, it's always great talking to you.
Rebecca, good to talk to you too.
We have to get one thing out of the way. Pam's husband, the victim in this case, his name is spelled D-O-R-I-A-N. I hear Doran. I hear Dorian. I myself said Doran at first in this episode. Is there a definitive pronunciation of this poor man's name?
I don't think so. Some people say Dorian. Some say Doran. I think most people probably say Doran. I don't know if that's the North Carolina accent, but we'll try to be more consistent this last episode. I think Doran is the preferred pronunciation.
Right, right. Okay, well, that's what I'll go with. But if anyone does it differently, that's okay, because the Undisclosed team has gone with it a few different ways in their own episodes. Allison, I'm curious, what have your thoughts been so far on this series? And do you have any questions for Colin about all the stuff that has gone down in the first three episodes?
Yeah, I had already talked to him, or I told Colin on Twitter, that the one thing that stood out for me right from the get-go was, you know, this law of what is the expression? Doctrine of chances, right? Because that is just, it does seem like, you know, you flip a coin 10 times, even if it comes up heads every time, the 11th time, it's still 50-50, right? Like, it just seems crazy to me that's a legal thing that people use. The other issue that blew my mind from the beginning was that whole drowning situation from an earlier episode where we were being told, like, you shouldn't go in the water and that's a thing people know, because I didn't know that. And that seems so impossible to me to watch someone drown from the shoreline. And you're like, oh, I hope you're okay. I'll call someone else for help. I mean, that was another sort of like showstopper for me. So this case is just blowing my mind. And then Pam's attitude is unbelievable. I love her. I want to be her friend. I want to hang out with her. Like, she has this like unsinkable spirit that is just so lovely and like human after everything she has been through. I find her so just forgiving and kind and still has this like enthusiasm for life that I find remarkable.
So pragmatic too, right? Like, she's so practical. Yeah. She's like, oh, we just did the best we could. And it was a, you know, for lack of a better word, it was like a real shit show, but we just handled it.
Yeah.
We did everything we could. Marcia, what about you? Like, what stuck out for you as you've listened to these episodes?
I really enjoyed it. First of all, I'm glad that there's a storyline that involves a woman, because I think so much of what we did on the Freddie Gray arc and so much of Undisclosed is about this kind of gap between people who are convicted or accused of crimes and then the people who are actually responsible for helping them or adjudicating it, whether it be their attorneys or the justice system broadly, the police or juries. And these disconnects are so shaped by just our assumptions about people. And so the thing that I think is really interesting about her story is just this kind of weird way that their lives just change so quickly in these different circumstances. So there's this kind of this experience of being completely destitute and being poor and being really subject to all these different waves. And then they get into this like turkey scheme. And I think she was getting something like 20 grand every few months for this turkey thing, right? And then the fortunes come, but then the fortunes get lost. And so I think that there's something really textured about her life story that the type of true crime representation, what was the name of that show she was on? Deadly Women.
Yeah.
You know, it flattens all of these details and it flattens that kind of human element where everyone is trying to do the best with what they have.
Right.
And so I think that it's unfortunate that so much of true crime, and I think podcasts have really helped disrupt this, but so much of true crime is that kind of flat narrative with the sinister music and the, you know, all the assumptions. And what we're able to do through podcasting is to kind of tell those deeper stories and bring real voices into it. Mm. And would hope that it helps people then have clear thinking about what they consume when they're on a jury or when they make judgments about stories they hear of other people.
Can I ask a question about that show? When did that air? When was that episode published?
That was 2014. So she was contacted, Pam, in prison by Candace DeLong earlier that year. And I think sometime in the fall of 2014, that episode premiered.
Because I sort of want to believe, I totally agree with what you were saying, except for that I want to believe that now people are starting to have less of an interest in that black and white version of true crime and more interest in all of those nuances and what is really going on. And maybe I'm naive about that, but I think that the most interesting cases and the ones you are covering and the ones people seem to be the most interested in talking about are the ones where you are torn, where you're not sure, where people's motives are confusing and conflicted. And maybe you end up doing the wrong thing, but you had good reasons. I hope that that's the direction we're headed anyway.
I think it's split. I mean, my experience is I still get pitched, as does my husband, Kevin, on doing plenty of these like terrible TV shows. And we basically just, I mean, Kevin will occasionally do them if he knows something about the case and he feels like he can add something. I won't do them anymore for this exact reason. But there is also just like, and you know, from working in TV, there's like a cheap production model, which is like really profitable, which is like, there's been a book on this. So we can do 8 episodes on these 8 different show properties on this network about it and pull in this author to do all these interviews. And unfortunately, like the way the true crime publishing industry worked for many, many, many years is that like they wouldn't do a book unless there was an adjudicated case and there was a verdict. And so like the nuance thing wasn't part of that formula. So it's sort of like the circular media beast that was, you know, fueling itself. And then also I have noticed there have been a couple of like premiere properties that have come out lately, like the Marcia Clark show is a good example, very prosecutor focused show. And when I watch that, as good as I think it is, like for what it is, like it does feel dated to me that it's so conviction focused and so prosecution focused. Maybe that is a signal that things are changing, is that that feels dated.
I hope so, because when Bob Ruff talked about his experience on Nancy Grace's show, I was so disappointed because I felt like this case deserves... That's just such an antiquated point of view to have. I mean, if that's really where you are, then you're stuck in the past. I mean, his voice needed to be given its time, and to cut him off and edit him out is just absurd.
Yeah. So Marcia was talking about like doing what you can do to get by. And Marcia, I did like it that you called the turkey farm like a turkey scheme. Because but you know what? It sounded that way to me, too. And I think that the layer this pulls back on like the small farmer food industry was super interesting. I, for one, am only going to be buying organic turkeys from now on. I don't know if anyone else feels that way. Like, you know,
I was totally getting the creepy crawlies when she was talking about like the medications that were just all over their house.
Or just going in and pulling out the dead ones. Like, yeah, we'd have to go in and pull out the dead ones. It's like, how many dead ones are
there? It was so gross. I couldn't believe it. I was, I just was so stunned by all of that. But you're right. Like, such an interesting, a whole other world that I know nothing about. So I found it fascinating, but also, yes, very shocking and very like, it's going to be a while before I eat turkey. Thank God Thanksgiving is a long time away.
Let's say you've started knitting toboggans and want to create a website to sell them. Or let's say you want to start a website about the use of arsenic in the poultry industry. Or let's say you want to start a website about how Cobra Kai is the best current show, but also undermines Johnny's character arc at the end of The Karate Kid. In all three cases, Squarespace has got you covered. With Squarespace, you can easily create a website by yourself and make it stand out from all the others. They have beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, the ability to customize look and feel, settings, products, and more with just a few clicks, analytics that help you grow in real time, and built-in search engine optimization. Plus, everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box, and they have 24/7 award-winning customer support. And now, Undisclosed listeners can head to squarespace.com/undisclosed for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code undisclosed to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/undisclosed.
Now, Colin, when you went to the prison to interview Pam, she asked you what she dubbed the $100 question.
Now, I'm going to ask you a $100 question. I don't know if you're married or not, but if you have a wife and she told you to go to the doctor and you don't want to go, would you go?
I probably would, but I have a very persuasive wife. But I know that many men can be very stubborn.
Right? Yes, I mean, I would be stubborn.
Right.
I mean, if I didn't want to go somewhere like that, I would not go. But no, you just don't tell a grown man, you know, you're going to go. That was the thing that Doug kept telling me over and over. They want you to sign this plea because they're saying you should have forced him to go. I said, I got him there 6 times. If he says no, what am I supposed to do with him? Hold a gun to his head and put him in the vehicle? I said, it don't work that way. I said, you can't make a grown man do something that he does not want to do.
Now, Marcia, what I heard in that conversation, and I don't know if you were attuned to this as well, is the social implications of lack of affordable health care. I hear a lot of that in that conversation because you hear about a man who is treating himself with the same drugs he uses to treat his animals, thinking like if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me. And then when you hear about the places where they actually went, it was like emergency rooms and minute clinics, basically, was where they went. They didn't go to, I mean, it didn't sound like anywhere from the list that I heard. It seemed very much like a story about, I mean, those are the consequences, right? If you don't have a lot of money and, you know, you're not insured, or I don't know if they had health insurance or not, but like for a lot of people in America, the options for healthcare are, they're not abundant and the ones that do exist are very expensive. So I heard that when I was listening to this part of the episode. Did you hear that too?
Absolutely. I think this is such an interesting story about like both gender and class together. And I think that considering all of these really kind of hackneyed pieces we see about real America and opioid addiction, I think that this story, again, more layers, because this whole idea that this guy is averse to going to the doctor, I think is a very common gendered thing. But one of the things that, you know, I can see also in the story is that they're always trying to get just a little bit ahead. And there's a kind of sense that like, you know, trying to scrape by, and then when money comes in, trying to be really judicious with it because you don't know what's going to happen next. And so this idea that they would ration access to healthcare makes perfect sense. Any person who grew up in the kind of pre-Affordable Care Act days of being afraid to go to the doctor because you're not sure if you can afford it, and that still exists today, or, you know, even myself as a professional with proper health insurance, I go to urgent care all the time.
Yeah,
because
me too.
Can't find a doctor or I don't have time. So there's all of these ways that these kind of systems, we see how it plays out in these people's lives. But I had a kind of question about using the animal medications. So it seems to me that after this accident he had.
Which sounds like it was a bad accident. It doesn't sound minor.
accident. Didn't seem minor. And I don't know if there's clearly something that happened to his kind of critical thinking. There's some, I don't know, I'm not a doctor, so I don't know if it's a brain injury, but there was something wrong. And then this use of the animal medication, I wasn't sure if one of the reasons why they didn't want to go to the doctor is if they were trying to evade discovery of some type of an addiction or some type of intoxication. It just seemed really like an extreme response, even in light of those economic issues that I raised, that this resistant.
I just want to weigh in that there's also like a, even just a human wanting to avoid the doctor, whether there's money or not. I know people who, you know, aren't in a situation where it's a problem financially. It's just that they have like just an instinctual horror or hatred of the doctor. You know, lots of people feel that way about the dentist. No offense to dentists who listen. I love the dentist. But some people feel like it means acknowledging there's something wrong. Like yeah. He kept saying, and I thought this was really... Pam kept saying that he would say, oh, if it keeps up, if this keeps happening for a couple days, I'll go. And I think that's also just innate in him and who he was. And I sort of know the feeling. I'm a bit like that myself. Like if I went to the doctor, that would be acknowledging that something's really wrong. And I don't have time for that. I'm busy.
Right.
And I have things to do. And I can go get something over the counter. I'll take some Tylenol and I'll be fine. You know, like I don't want to admit that something's wrong. And obviously this seems like a very extreme version of that. But I mean, for example, I had a pretty serious injury to my knee a year ago, and I really was like, take me to Rite Aid, I'll get an ACE bandage, and I'm going to be fine. And I really thought that. And my husband, like, he kind of laughed and laughed me all the way to the emergency room.
Yeah.
And but the whole time I was like, I just, you know, I'll have a cocktail and an ACE bandage, and I'll be fine. And then they told me I tore four ligaments in my knee. And I just feel like, that's this guy. And so I wonder, like, what's her responsibility as the spouse? This was the part that started to feel really muddy. Like, I remember that feeling from my point of view. And my husband just sort of picked me up and put me in the car and was like, think whatever you want. I'm driving you to the emergency room.
Right.
And there's an interesting gender issue there as the wife, I think, especially at that time, maybe, or more than now, I guess, where she deferred to his wishes. And is there a weird, like... spousal responsibility to push harder?
Well, there is with kids. Colin, is there a legal precedent for like a spousal responsibility like there is with, you know, the legal responsibility to care for children?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit muddier. So in the law, we have this requirement known as the actus reus requirement, which says generally you have to do a voluntary act to be culpable, which would be a stabbing, a shooting, a poisoning, etc. But there's certain what they call status relationships where they say if you stand in a certain status to someone, you have this duty. So, of course, parent-child, if your child is sick, you have this duty to get them help. With a spouse, that duty exists. But the question is, what's the scope of that duty? Because obviously a child can't drive, can't get themselves medical care, whereas the spouse, an adult, would have that ability. And that's one of the questions present here with the plea deal that was offered for involuntary manslaughter is exactly what was the scope of her obligation? As Pam likes to repeat, I got him to the doctor 6 times in those 2 months and he was kicking and screaming the whole way. And the question sort of becomes, what more do you expect of her to do other than, you know, trying the best she can to get him to the doctor?
Right. Of course you knew that off the top of your head, by the way. I just want the audience to know, like, that was not in the notes. And Colin's ability, your ability to summon up legal terms and court cases to support everything that you say is like, to me, that's your superpower. So just so you know, I'm very envious of that. One thing I wanted to mention, I couldn't stop thinking when there was this whole long section in the episode where we heard about how Doran was drinking the medicated turkey water, how everyone saw him do it, how, you know, he knew he wasn't supposed to do it, but he kept doing it. I looked it up, and I don't know if, Colin, you looked into this at all. I found a few articles that pointed to arsenic as being kind of addictive. One of the effects of the poison is euphoria. That's kind of one of the toxicity effects. And that there have been cases and there have been cultures that actually drank arsenic on purpose to achieve these effects. Do you think that perhaps that's what was feeding that? That it wasn't just him being too lazy to switch the hose over, that he was a little bit addicted? Is it possible that he's a little bit addicted to this arsenic water? Because he did say when he was finally taken to the hospital, like, I did this to myself.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned it. There were people who lived up in the mountains in the Alps, and they would eat arsenic to be able to tolerate living at the higher altitudes. And arsenic has been shown to be addictive, and also it's been shown to cause neurological issues. So I think both of these were potentially in play here, and we'll cover this a bit more in episode 4. But yeah, A, it's possible that when he started taking it, he had an addiction. And then B, it's also possible once he started taking it, it was causing neurological damage, which then caused him to engage in certain behaviors like using these animal medications that a rational person wouldn't do. But maybe based upon the damage to his brain, it became sort of justified in his head.
So, Colin, do you think that, you know, Pam talked about some of the health issues she had when the turkey farm was active that then went away when they got rid of the turkeys. Do you think that she was seeing some of the effects maybe from like the groundwater seepage or something from all these chemicals that were being used on the turkeys?
I think it's quite possible. There was a case in Arkansas that we're going to talk about in episode 4 where there were turkey farmers using the 3-nitro, and the claim by some experts in that case was a child who lived adjacent to those farms was inhaling that 3-nitro, and that was causing serious medical issues analogous to the ones that Pam was suffering. So it's not quite definitive, and it's unclear that we can pin it to that. But if you look at the timeline, she's generally doing okay. She meets Doran. She starts turkey farming. She's exposed to the 3-nitro, and she has these medical conditions. And then essentially, when that turkey farming ends, those medical conditions go away. So, I mean, certainly we have a correlation there. Possibly we have a causation.
So that brings up a question I had regarding all these trips to the doctor. I feel like the medical care he did receive raises a lot of questions for me. I mean, this Dr. Jordan seemed very quick to, like, you know, sort of guess that he has this or that. And never did they mention, like, she keeps telling, Pam kept telling this doctor, whoever she was dealing with at the hospital, that he is self-medicating, that he's taking, like, old medicines and animal medicines. Like, I don't feel like there was ever a response from the doctor, like, you can't do that. He can't. And never did they really diagnose what was wrong with him. So part of me feels like there's a big hole here with the care that she did get for him and how they quickly dismissed it as sort of like whatever symptoms they could see on the surface. And they didn't, you know, I feel they're culpable here too. And yet that obviously is nothing that was brought up at trial.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this is something where, as you noted, in this case, we have several doctor's notes where she's saying he's medicating himself. There's that interesting note where she's telling the nurse, look, he's going to get mad at me if I tell you, but here's this syringe, and he's been using it to inject medications into himself. I mean, if I'm the doctor there, the nurse, that throws up all sorts of red flags that there could be issues here. And it just doesn't seem like there's any follow-up. And then that creates issues at trial because these doctors are kind of gun-shy about being fully honest about what happened because you have to think they might fear it comes back on them. So, yeah, I agree, Allison. This is something where I have questions about how the doctors handled what Pam was telling them.
I had a question about the prosecution's case. Where did they say she sourced all this arsenic that she was giving him? If the arsenic that's in the turkey medication is not the same type of arsenic they think poisoned him, did they ever try to make some claim as to where she was getting all this arsenic?
They did not. And it's essentially this whole idea that we had with the Sherlock Holmes and his maxim and the idea of eliminating the impossible. And essentially, their argument was a person doesn't die from ingesting arsenic in the environment. He must have been poisoned, and she's the primary caretaker. Now, we can't point you in the direction of any arsenic that was found in the house that could have been used, but, you know, what other theory is there for him dying? And that's, Marcia, then essentially what the state's case is process elimination. What else could have been the cause?
Now, I always think about all of the television shows and films I've seen where there's been a crime committed and it's a poisoning. And I think about all of the times I have seen a fictional investigator or detective or, you know, lawyer say poisoning is a woman's crime. I don't know if any of you guys have heard that. I've heard that many, many, many times in pop culture. And Marcia, you tweeted, you know, following one of the episodes, you know, just listening to the new episode and thinking how I'd talk about the history of stories about women poisoning husbands. What were you talking about and what would you want to say? This is your opportunity.
Well, this was a real popular trope in the 19th century that hasn't left us. This idea of women who, because of, you know, women are smaller and more delicate than men, that their only access to kind of revenge on men is through domestic crimes like poisoning. So it's this kind of perfect lady crime because it involves a kind of deceit that only a woman can pull off because it involves poisoning food. And so in the 19th century, a lot of newspapers would serialize these stories about women poisoning their husbands. And part of the depiction of it was you kind of felt bad for her because this was her only escape from a brutish or terrible or abusive husband. And as that trope continued to kind of grow throughout the 20th century, there are different versions of it. I think sometimes true crime stories about mothers with Munchausens by proxy is another one. So it's the ways that women as caretakers can go off the rails, and then they start to use the domestic sphere to take out revenge. And you see it. I mean, like most recently, the Lady Gaga video with Beyonce, where they go into the diner and they've like poisoned everyone in it. You also see it in, you know, the classic film Flowers in the Attic, where the grandma is, you know, poisoning the kids with the donuts with the arsenic. And so there's a way that this idea is so potent that I would imagine that when the jury is listening to this case, it makes perfect sense that this woman has sourced arsenic and given it to her husband, because how else would a woman who is after money or who's up to something no good, how else would she pull this off? And so I think that those are the types of the pieces of cultural baggage that I think people bring into these cases. And I think for the prosecutor, you know, if we're all coming from a similar or the same cultural context, talking about a woman who's had these husbands who've died under mysterious circumstances now comes up with poisoning, it starts to make sense, even though it is based on no real evidence.
Right, right. Now, Allison, you have played a woman on Days of Our Lives. One of the arcs, as Colin pointed out in his notes, by the way, I want you to know he included this, that you were framed for a murder and given the death penalty on Days of Our Lives. Your character was Sammy Brady, before later being proven innocent. Do you feel like you are part of this cultural baggage that... No, I'm just... That's not
well,
a serious
all,
question.
Rebecca, you're
that was not
Colin
my question.
Short for, like, just claiming he's, like, legal serious.
That's
because
right.
Because he actually has this breadth of knowledge of
he's
TV
incredible.
And film
yep.
history that, like, doubles down on his legal understanding. I mean, look, like, I've played these stories out and done the poisoning and been the one accused of poisoning, and the funny thing about my character is, like, of all the horrible things she did not, in fact, murder that guy. And so she was sort of falsely accused and convicted based on her reputation, based right. on what everybody knew about her. And, you know, I mean, there was something about that that was so, you know, sort of great and in some ways, obviously now looking back on it, so true, right? Like, you know, who she was and that she had been flirting with some guy, or, you know, like her reputation preceded her into that courtroom, and the presumption of innocence was, you know, gone from the get-go.
Yeah.
And so I think that, yeah, we in Hollywood absolutely propagate these reputations and these stories that have been around for a long time and fulfill these stereotypes all the time. I mean, it is what people expect. It's what it is also not just because they're the weaker, right? Gender. There's like a distance from it too, right?
Right.
I mean, to stab someone, you could probably make it happen while your husband's sleeping or hit him with a frying pan or something. But the poison gives you a, not that I've thought about this at length, but I just thought, you know, from what I've heard, there's a distance, right? So you're not actually, you may, maybe not even in the room when it happens or when the symptoms start to take effect, you know, you can kind of, I think that's also something about it that I think makes it feminine, where you believe that men would want to beat the crap out of someone and really face them all, you know, face to face when it happens. And that's another, I mean, not to say that that's really how it is, but that would be part of the stereotype.
It's
I would
a trope.
Imagine.
I mean, this, I think the poison at women, yeah. you know, the lady crime is a trope. It's been around for a long time, as Marcia pointed out. And it's not your, certainly not your fault or your writer's fault. I mean, it is an expected story arc. And I don't think, you know, we can change that necessarily, but certainly separating what you see in pop culture from what you do in the courtroom as a juror is, you know, that is a choice I think we can make and maybe do a better job in the courtroom of talking about not being adulterated by these pop culture stereotypes.
Yeah, I think educating the jury is a huge part of what needs to happen moving forward, and helping them see through what these stereotypes are and what the both lawyers, you know, both sets of attorneys are, their obligation is, you know, and helping jurors recognize that it is all part of the show. I mean, now I think ever since, and probably before Johnny Cochran, but I think he gets credit for really making it a spectacle and a show and telling a story and winning the jury over to your story. I think we need the jurors to be more educated to like see through that and really sort of do the math for themselves. And I, obviously with not violating any jurors' instructions, of course, you can't just bring in your own information or run tests all by yourself or anything like that. But you know, seeing through the act of what these lawyers are doing is important too, right?
Moms are the best. My mom was a teacher, and among other things, she gave me my love for teaching, both in the classroom and on this podcast. And along with many of you, I'll be telling my mom how much I love her this Sunday for Mother's Day. But doesn't mom deserve more than one day? When you send her Pro Flowers for Mother's Day, she's guaranteed to have at least 7 days of fresh, beautiful flowers. This is the last week you can send 100 colorful blooms with a free glass vase for just $19.99 plus shipping and handling with my promo code undisclosed. Mother's Day is this Sunday. Don't forget to show mom how much she means to you. Send her 100 colorful blooms with a free glass vase for just $19.99 plus shipping and handling. Visit proflowers.com, click on the blue microphone in the upper right corner, and use my promo code undisclosed. That's proflowers.com, code undisclosed.
So, Colin, why do you think the jury didn't give Pam the death penalty, given what the state argued in this case? Why do you think they came to that decision? Do you have any idea?
There was an expert who testified during sentencing that he thought that Pam would acclimate to prison and be a model prisoner and be helpful and would not be a threat to others.
Hmm.
I'm not sure how convincing that was. In my mind, I think this has to be a case where the jury was undecided about guilt.
Right.
Because the state's theory is she killed not one but two husbands, did it in cold blood. With Doran, it was chronic arsenic poisoning, meaning that she was poisoning him over a period of weeks or months. There was a claimed financial motive. So even with that expert, I have to think if the jury was 100% convinced that she was guilty of these crimes, they would have given the death penalty. So I think the expert may have held some sway, but I have to think at the end of the day that at least some of these jurors were questioning the evidence, and it was enough for them to convict, but not enough for them to be convinced that she should die.
What was the gender composition of the jury? Do you know?
Yeah, it was 6-6. So 6 men, 6 women, and 1 African-American male, 1 African-American female. The other 10 were Caucasian.
Did she take the stand at her trial?
She did not. And I have a clip with my conversation with her in the last episode discussing what she went through with her attorneys about whether she should testify or not.
Before we leave the trial, can we talk about Ali Bradshaw and those sort of personal people who testified, and you said it so well, right? Like that their testimony in and of itself wasn't necessarily what was so damning. It was their tone. It was the way they turned against her. And that, you know, when your friends are up there on the stand thinking you're guilty, whether they come right out and say it or not, that's really damning, I'm sure, to the jury.
Yeah. What's up with Ali Bradshaw, Colin?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we had that recorded call that she did with Pam where she said the state's claiming that I helped you to kill Doran. So you can imagine how that's going to lead her to be a state's witness as opposed to standing next to Pam. And then I don't even begin to try to understand the dynamics there with she's giving her police statement with her husband there. And it's the same husband who abused her and kicked her out. And then Pam and Doran took her in. So
Pam's
that's
the enemy.
Tough to unpack.
Pam,
right?
Pam could be the enemy in that relationship. That's what happens in abusive relationships. I mean, I've had been this experience myself where I am the friend who brings somebody in who's in a terrible relationship, and then she goes back, and then you become the enemy, not just of the man, but of the relationship. Like, you become the enemy. Kevin and I wrote a book about it called Notes on a Killing, where that exact situation happened, and the enemy of the relationship Penn Meyer ended up being a murder victim by the abusive guy who saw her as the enemy of his relationship.
Yeah, and I really tried. I left a few messages. I talked to one of her relatives. I really wanted to record a phone call with Allie to get her take on it now. And she just wouldn't answer my calls and talk to me about the case.
Hmm. Do we know if she's still with that husband?
I'm not sure about that. Yeah, I don't know.
And of course, that what I just said was, of course, speculation. I just want to make that clear. I'm just saying, right, when you talk about it being complicated to unpack, like, that is a scenario that came to my mind right away, that, you know, this is where she was hiding or living after she left him. So, of course, you know, when they get back together, if there is a pattern of abuse and control, it's not unlikely that he would then say, you know, it's her fault. You know, don't put yourself in the way when she could be the one getting in trouble.
Well, I listen to Laura Richards' podcast all the time about the coercive control. And, you know, right off the bat, you can just opens the mind to all speculation of if he was abusive enough for her to leave him, that he's willing to do anything to get her back. And the fact that the police let him remain in the room for that interview is sort of
bananas.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Shockingly inappropriate, I would think, no matter what his involvement is.
Colin, can any claims be made about just kind of the, you know, the poor investigative issues like this one, for instance, that you have a witness who might be under duress being questioned, you know, in the presence of an abuser and some of the other things that happened in this case?
Yeah, I mean, these are all things that the defense can raise at trial, and they raised some of them, certainly, to say that these were issues, for instance, with Jackie Hatcher and the whole attempt by him to buy the farm and how that might have tainted his testimony. These are all things you can sort of poke holes in at trial, but the question is whether it's actually very convincing to the jury. And in this case, it seems like the jury was fairly convinced by this whole package of evidence that the prosecution had presented to them.
Hmm. Now, Colin, you opened the episode with that Sherlock Holmes maxim, which we've all heard in lots of variations. And I love that you mentioned the Star Trek one, because I remember that very clearly. Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. Colin, what bothers you so much about this maxim?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that definitely, A, informs a lot of jurors' thinking at trial, and then B, informs a lot of appellate judges. And that is the case where you have a defendant and they have a motive to kill this victim. And even when you've said, well, we have ineffective assistance of counsel, or we have bad forensic evidence, or we have prosecutorial misconduct, the comments by jurors or people listening to true crime or judges is always, okay, but who else had a motive to harm this victim? We can sort of eliminate anyone else as having that motive, and therefore it must have been that defendant. And I just think that's entirely the wrong way to go about these cases. I think really what you have to do is you have to look at the evidence against this defendant, assess it, and in a vacuum determine, is this enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt this defendant committed the crime? And I don't think it makes sense, and I don't think it's fair to look at it from the perspective of, well, we can eliminate other people as having an obvious motive, and therefore it must have been this person, because there's just so many cases where, A, there's no motive whatsoever, or B, you just simply don't have enough evidence to know what the motive could be in this case.
Right, and your list may not include the people who might have possibly done it. I mean, that's the thing that always sticks out to me in the Adnan Syed case, is the elimination of a stranger. Like, that possibility seems to have been eliminated, like, almost immediately, and given the kinds of crimes that were happening in that area, like, it's not impossible that it could have been a stranger in that case, and yet that a stranger wasn't on the list. Like that.
Or
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, or in this case, where it might not have been anyone, or he might, you know, he brought it on himself,
right.
Certainly not intentionally. Or there's sort of a case recently of a woman who the arson investigation was at a time like kind of junk science. And so this woman got convicted of murdering her child in burning down her trailer. And it turns out, oh, sorry, we were wrong about the science. It actually was just an accident, you know?
Right.
And that, I mean, it could be no one. It could just have happened. These things sometimes, you know, it's sad and tragic, but sometimes they're just, it just happens. And for us to look for someone guilty, someone with a motive, that seems to totally go against the innocent until proven guilty.
Now, Marcia, I know you grade a lot of college papers, and this is, I think, a pretty clear example of a fallacy. And I'm curious to know what you think about this maxim. Do you agree that it's a fallacy? And would you put a red pen through it if a student handed in, you know, a paper that had this in there and asserted that it was truth?
Yeah, I think that the kind of the lack of depth of the kind of the fact that the consequence of this kind of thinking, the thing that is so alarming, especially when we think about it in the justice system, it's annoying in student papers, but it's actually tragic. This idea that there's kind of like no rigorous attempt to actually get to this point, right? So let's say that they investigated this case 4 years and they said, well, there's just no other way that we can get here, but this lady did it. I'm still bothered by that, but at least there is some kind of transparency on how they jumped to that conclusion. But in this case, it just seems like by virtue of this man being married to a woman who had a spouse die, like that was it. And that really is unsettling because I don't think it's uncommon in the framing of a prosecution case and as well as people's thinking about whether people are guilty or innocent. And so it undermines our ability to kind of think rationally about not only evidence itself, but the need for evidence. Mm. And I'm just curious, Colin, did the defense raise the fact that this man was self-medicating over a period of time with medication that wasn't designed for humans? Because it seems like this fact seems really important in kind of breaking down the inevitability that it had to be the wife. You know, back to Allison's point about the self-harm that this guy had been doing for a while, did that come up in the trial?
They brought it up somewhat. Now, interestingly, there was one witness who probably had the best information on that front, and we're going to hear from him in episode 4. He ultimately, as we'll see, was not called at trial because he had the same name as another person who had a sordid history and a string of convictions. And so defense counsel thought the jurors would confuse him with this other man. And so this person was a wealth of information about all the medications that Doran was taking, and the jury never heard from him.
What? Oh, my
yeah,
God.
It's very...
Joking. Was the guy's name like Jeffrey Dahmer or something?
No, not someone infamous like this. Jackie Graham was his name. And this case was actually the jurisdiction was changed. So all the pretrial publicity we heard about, like the exhumation of Johnny Ray, et cetera, there was so much press in Duplin County where this crime allegedly took place. It was moved to Wayne County, which is about 45 minutes north, where this person with the same name resided. And it's one of those decisions, again, like not introducing the exhumation autopsy results for Johnny Ray, where the defense counsel just thought we're going to confuse jurors and let's not present this. But when you look at it in hindsight, it doesn't seem to make much sense that they didn't call this witness.
We actually got a question from Abby that kind of like ties to some of this what did and didn't come up at trial stuff. You guys talked a lot about the medical visits, the 6 doctor's appointments, but Abby Smith on Twitter asked about his leg, the actual original injury that started all this. She's curious about sepsis and gangrene, weakened immune system, et cetera, but curious to know if that original injury was ever discussed at the trial, was ever really diagnosed in these medical appointments? Because it doesn't seem that way, Colin. It seems like it was a lot of gastrointestinal stuff that was kind of put out there.
Yeah, and even this last ER visit on the day he dies, there aren't any notations about the condition of his leg. As you know, it really is through the course of these 2 months, other than the initial visit and him stopping use of the antibiotics and then being told to take them again. Right, the focus of all these visits are these gastric issues, his neurological issues, and there's just not much discussion of the actual condition of his leg. So we're not sure how bad that injury was during those few months.
Hmm. Marsha or Allie, do you have any more questions for Colin about the case so far?
Yeah, I was going to ask about like where it stands today. Does she have any grounds for a post-conviction relief hearing?
Yeah, so this is something that is very promising and hopeful. So we believe that we have determined the cause of Doran's death. We have several experts lined up. You'll hear from some of them in episode 4. And the goal as of now is to file, it's called a motion for appropriate relief, this summer. And yeah, we think we've solved this case. We think we know how Doran died. We think we can prove that it's not Pam. And we're hopeful that she's going to get some relief.
Are you saying that someone knows something in this case, Colin?
We have some new facts. Yeah. So those new facts are helpful in terms of the case. But we also have new expert conclusions that are telling us information that was not available at the time of trial that is very striking in terms of what it can tell us about Doran's possible cause of death.
Hmm. I had a question just kind of about the problems of the justice system broadly. The change of venue question I always think is really interesting because historically it has helped sometimes, occasionally, African-American defendants, especially, you know, in the 60s and 70s, a change of venue could actually help versus harm. But I'm curious about a case like this in which it's not being moved that far away. And the idea of kind of informal networks, particularly in rural America, in a case like this, do you think a change in venue was necessary or was made a material difference in Pam's case?
Yeah, well, I think first it was absolutely necessary based upon the amount and the tenor of the pretrial publicity. It had to be moved. In fact, I would say it should have been moved farther away than it was. And then, Marcia, to your point about informal networks, this is something that when I was talking to the people at Wake Forest, they really wanted us to investigate was talking to the jurors and seeing whether, despite their claims during jury selection, they in fact had pre-existing knowledge of the case that might have tainted what happened at trial. We made some efforts to reach out to the jurors. I found numbers for all 12 of them. Most of the numbers didn't work. When we reached out to people, we did have the correct numbers. They weren't willing to speak. So that ended up being a dead end where they wouldn't speak to us. But I absolutely would not be surprised at all if some of these jurors had some familiarity with the case and that didn't, you know, that very well could have tainted their views going into the trial.
Colin, do you know what happened to the land? The land really seems to be a central point of contention here and theme. You know, she says that some witnesses may have turned on her because they wanted to buy her land and she wouldn't let them. We have questions about whether or not the family interfered with the investigation because of their desire to keep the land in Doran's family. What happened to that land, ultimately? Do you know?
Yeah, it's in Doran's family. I think the son lives on it now. When they went out to visit the Wake Forest people, I think they actually visited that land. We heard from Mark Rabel in the clip where they were saying how nice the land was compared to the surrounding areas. So, yeah, as a result of Pam being convicted, she was not entitled to inherit the land, and therefore it stayed in the Lanier family.
Hmm. Do either one of you have any final questions I can tee up for you?
No, I'm anxious to hear what happens next. Colin, you know, you had me hooked at an amazing throwback reference to Arsenic and Old Lace, one of my all-time favorite movies. Certainly the best Cary Grant movie. It's fantastic. So speaking of little old ladies, spoiler alert, little old ladies poisoning people. I thought that was such a great hook for me. I was like, if I didn't love the show more, you just won me over all over again.
Yeah, I have to say the same, Colin. I edit the show, so I probably see how the sausage is made more than anyone. And when I am as thoroughly, dare I say, entertained and fascinated by a story, like you have really found and researched and put together a tremendous, tremendous story here with this case. I'm so proud to work on these episodes. They're just so, so good.
Yeah, and that Arsenic and Old Lace reference is not just sort of a throwaway. It's actually pretty central to the biggest expert, I think, in this area. And it was central to some of the research she's done. So that'll all play out in episode 4.
Oh, can't wait to hear it. Well, Colin, thank you so much for doing all the research and all the heavy lifting to make this story possible. And also for all your notes to help me out with the addendum. I really appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
And Allison Sweeney, always a pleasure to talk to you. I may be the biggest gainer, but we will always be sisters in true crime.
No, you're awesome. I love it. I love being a part of this show. Thank you for including me again. It was awesome. And we'll stay in touch on Twitter, Rebecca.
And Marcia Chatelain, I learned something very much like Colin. I learned something new every time I talk to you, whether it's about home improvements, true crime, or the history of culture in America. It's always, always great to talk to you about these cases.
I love this show so much, and I really do appreciate the ways that you tell a big story, and I think this is so educational. I'm so, so excited to hear what happens next.
Undisclosed executive producer is Meethal Telhan, without whom none of these shows would happen. Thank you so much, Meethal, for all your hard work, for keeping things on track, and for telling me what it is I need to do and where I need to be. These episodes are produced by the amazing Hannah McCarthy, award-winning journalist and all-around terrific person. Thanks so much again to Colin Miller for all his help, his research, his notes, and all his prep to make these episodes sound great and to make me sound a little bit smarter than I walked in being. And thank you so much to everyone at the Undisclosed team for letting me host this series. For everyone at Undisclosed, I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and I look forward to talking to you next week.